I'm excited to tell you about the world's number one expanding garden hose and their brand new product, the Pocket Hose Ballistic. Look, I do not like taking care of my lawn. I abuse my hose. I drag it all over the asphalt driveway. I tug it this way. I tug it that way. But the Pocket Hose Ballistic handles it all. This hose has changed my landscaping life. It's the toughest pocket hose ever built, reinforced with liquid crystal polymer used in bulletproof vests, something I know a little bit about. It's super lightweight, easy to manage, easy to store, and when you want to use it, you turn the water on, it grows, and then when you turn the water off, it shrinks back down to pocket size. Pretty self-explanatory. It also comes with the pocket pivot, which gives you total freedom of movement at the spigot with 360-degree rotation. You move, it follows, and the water flows. And listen, I'm sure there are some of you saying, Derek, it's just a hose. But the pocket hose carries over 100 patents worldwide. So this isn't your typical hose. And now, for a limited time, when you purchase a new Pocket Hose Ballistic, you'll get a free 360-degree rotating pocket pivot and a free thumb drive nozzle. Just text DETECTIVE to 64000. That's DETECTIVE to 64000 for your two free gifts with your purchase. One more time. Text DETECTIVE to 64000. Message and data rates may apply.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. And when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
On May 16th, 2003, a silent alarm was triggered inside the Blue Ridge Savings Bank in Greer, South Carolina. When officers arrived just minutes later, they found the bank empty and the cash drawer cleared out. In a small utility room at the back of the building, they made a devastating discovery. Head teller Sylvia Holtzclaw, along with customers Dr. Ebb Barnes and his wife Maggie Barnes, had been all shot and killed. Grainy video from nearby gas stations showed a red car speeding away from the area, but investigators have never been able to identify the driver. More than 20 years later, the triple homicide at Blue Ridge Savings Bank remains unsolved, and detectives are still searching for the person or people responsible. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective, and each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Before I talk about the case, I just want to mention for anybody who doesn't follow me on Crime Weekly, CrimeCon is right around the corner. If you're someone who's interested in going, right now on Crime Weekly, we have a giveaway. All you have to do is go over there, click the link. It's going to bring you to a document and you can win two free tickets. If you're not interested in the giveaway or you want to go regardless, head on over to crimecon.com. You can buy your tickets and make sure you use the code CRIMEWEEKLY. It's all one word and you'll get 10% off your tickets. If you're not familiar with CrimeCon, I can't go into everything here, but I'll tell you, it's an amazing time. You're going to get to see a lot of the true crime creators that you've seen not only on TV, but on YouTube and in podcasts. You get to interact with them. And the best part about CrimeCon, at least for me, is getting to meet some of the families of the victims that we cover. This is a networking event. It allows them to get a hold of us. They get access to us immediately right in person where they can share their cases. And I get to put a name with a face. So it's a win-win on both sides. And if you've never had the opportunity to attend and you're in the Vegas area or you don't mind traveling, this is definitely the year to do so because, hey, we're going to be there, right? So I hope to see you there. Again, you can go to crimecon.com, enter code CRIMEWEEKLY, or you can go over to Crime Weekly right now and fill out the doc and maybe win two free tickets. All right, so this case is a head scratcher. We're looking at 20 years later, and we have a possible vehicle, even a few possible suspects, and yet no arrests. And this case reminds me a lot of the Lane Bryant murders that we covered here. Although in that case, I'm more optimistic that the person responsible was from the area based on where it occurred. Where here, when we get into it and you start to see the lay of the land, it's very possible that this person was just passing through. I can't tell you how close this bank is to the highway. Literally right out the front window, there's maybe 15 to 20 feet between the bank and the highway. It's literally right there. So immediately when I looked at this case, I said, oh, there's a possibility this person committed this crime, got on the highway, and never looked back. That was my first thought. However, when you start to look at the case and some of the eyewitness testimony, it's also possible that we've already discovered who the person was who committed this crime, or we have a sketch of the individual and yet they haven't been caught. So there's a few different wrinkles in this case that makes it fascinating from a detective perspective, but I'd really like to get your opinion on it. And I think ultimately the way we're going to solve this case is by someone coming forward. I've watched some of the videos surrounding this case, and you can tell how much it's affected not only law enforcement, not only the family and friends of the victims, but the entire community. Greer is a very small community. It's tight-knit. These people were known to the community there, and they're still 20-plus years later affected by it. And I'm going to talk about some of the things that they've done to carry on the legacies of the victims. So we have a lot to cover. I don't want to waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. Sylvia K. Holtzclaw was born on September 8, 1946. She grew up in Greer, South Carolina, a small city located off Interstate 85 between Greenville and Spartanburg. After high school, Sylvia got married and welcomed two sons, David and Kevin. Unfortunately, the marriage didn't last, and they divorced when the two boys were young. Sylvia then raised them as a single mom. Everyone in Greer knew Sylvia. She was a pillar of her community and a familiar face around town. She ran a toy drive for local children and made sure everyone felt supported. Sylvia's son said she was very giving. The only thing she wouldn't share were her brownies from her favorite bakery, and who can blame her for that? By 2000, Sylvia's sons were adults. David was living and working in Florida, while Kevin stayed in town and worked as a firefighter. Sylvia could often be found at the station helping with whatever was needed. In 2001, she took a job as head teller at the Blue Ridge Savings Bank in Greer. This was a very small branch located inside a mobile home style trailer, and because of its size, large amounts of cash weren't kept on hand. It primarily served customers with savings and loan accounts. And if you look at the map here, you look at some of the videos, some of the photos, you can see what I'm talking about. It is literally a mobile trailer. And as I said earlier, it's right basically on the highway. It almost looks like a rest stop. Other than signage, if you drove by there, you wouldn't even know it's a bank. Now, there were only three or four employees at the bank, so Sylvia often worked alone, which was something that worried her sons. To make matters worse, the bank's location was also a concern. As I just mentioned, it sat at 330 East Frontage Road, which was a short, dead-end road near the intersection of Interstate 85 and SC-14. David later told the Unsolved Mysteries podcast that Sylvia was very safety conscious, and she even created the safety manual for the bank, which she followed every day to a T. And when she opened the bank each morning, she made sure to put a new VHS tape in the surveillance system, which was located in the utility room. And this is important, right? I say 2003, and you're automatically thinking, oh, it's uploading to the cloud. Not so fast. Spoiler alert. Yes, we're old. And in 2003, it wasn't as prevalent at all to use cloud-based services. at that point, people were still recording locally on tapes and they had to be switched every single day. And if you didn't switch the videotape, more than likely it would be recorded over, but there were some problems with that. Anybody who had a VHS knows that, yeah, you could re-record over something, but the quality dropped right off a cliff. On top of that, if you allowed it to record over the previous day, if something had happened, like employee theft or there was a question with a customer, you lost that footage. So it was repetition, and they replaced that tape every day so there was a fresh one ready to go. And in addition to changing the VHS tapes every single day, Sylvia also consistently used the front door security feature, requiring anyone who wanted to enter to be buzzed in. And I think this is something that most of us are familiar with or we have seen, where you walk up to the door, but there has to be an employee or manager who hits a button and then unlocks the door from that button so that you can enter. You'll hear the buzz, you go inside, and you're good to go. Now, this was something that was more prevalent back in the early 2000s. We don't see it as much now, and I'm not completely sure why. My first thought is that there's a lot of potential litigation there. Imagine employees or managers not allowing service to someone because of the way they're dressed or how they look and the potential implications of that from a lawsuit perspective. That's probably part of it, but if anybody else there has more insight, let me know. I'm always pro-security, but I also think now we've had a lot of advancements in science and technology, and video camera footage has gotten exponentially better. So I think the thought process is, hey, if they want to come in and they want to do something stupid with 17 cameras around, that's on them. So going into this, just to recap, we have the security system, and we also have the buzz feature. So it allows Sylvia to have control of who's entering the building, and if they do enter, they're going to be caught on camera. So you would think, okay, not the best situation for her to be alone, but she should be okay. Well, let's fast forward to the morning in question, which was May 16th, 2003, where Sylvia was working at the Blue Ridge Savings Bank as usual. She was the only employee in the building that day, and she quickly noticed the locking mechanism on the front door wasn't working, which meant she no longer had the ability to buzz people in. This was obviously a safety concern, so she called to have it repaired, but unfortunately, they did not fix it that day. So right off the rip, the best security defense that Sylvia had is not working. It's inoperable. So now she's a sitting duck. Anybody can come and go as they please. She has no opportunity to slow someone down and assess the situation before letting them inside. And the second security measure that we talked about was the video surveillance, but we can all agree, that's not going to stop someone if they really want to do something. It's more of a something that's used after the fact to apprehend the person. So as far as Sylvia's safety is concerned, she's in a bad situation already. And on top of that, at lunchtime, Sylvia had plans to leave for the day to spend time with her sons, but the coworker scheduled to relieve her said she couldn't come in, so Sylvia was forced to stay the entire day. At around 12:50 p.m., David brought Sylvia lunch. He later told Unsolved Mysteries that there were no customers inside and Sylvia was alone. David stayed for about 10 minutes and left at 1 p.m., expecting to see his mom later that afternoon, but tragically, he'd never see her again. Just a half hour later, at 1:30 p.m., the silent alarm at the bank was tripped, so dispatchers called the bank to see what was going on, but they didn't get a response. It seemed as if the line was disconnected or dead, so officers were dispatched to the area. When they arrived 17 minutes later, they found the bank empty and the cash drawer cleared out. Now, authorities have never revealed how much money was actually taken. They've only described it as being, quote, relatively little money. And that's no surprise. Based on what I've described to you, this bank was physically very small, but in an area that wouldn't need a lot of cash on hand, and they didn't have the employees to handle that much money. So not a surprise at all. I will tell you that it's my belief that at least $100 was taken. Why? Well, we're going to hit on it again later, but it's going to be quick. What we do know is that law enforcement would later release the serial numbers for five $20 bills. I'm not a mathematician, but that's $100 right there. So even if there wasn't another dollar in the bank, which I highly doubt, we know we have at least $100 taken, which in context to what we're talking about here and thinking about the loss of three lives, to imagine that these people were taken from us for only a couple $100 makes this case that much worse. So when officers arrived, they walked through the bank, and in a utility room at the back, they found three bodies. 56-year-old Sylvia Holtzclaw, 60-year-old Dr. James Albert Barnes, who went by Eb, and his wife, 58-year-old Margaret Barnes, who went by Maggie. And what makes it even worse is that all three officers at the scene immediately recognized them. The Herald Journal reported that Eb and Maggie were customers at the bank. Eb was a physics professor at the University of South Carolina upstate in Spartanburg, where he had taught for 28 years and had served twice as the interim dean. Eb was the type of professor that everyone loved. He was funny and supportive. He taught many students over the course of his career, and in fact, three of the officers who responded to the scene had once been in his class. Maggie, Eb's wife of nearly 40 years, was also deeply involved in the community as well. She worked with the National Beta Club and was a talented spinner and weaver, selling her work at craft fairs and partnering with Eb to give demonstrations at schools. Together, Maggie and Eb had three children, Katie, Dick, and Beth, and amongst them, there were six grandchildren. By the spring of 2003, Eb was preparing for retirement and had decided to step away from teaching. On May 16th, he and Maggie went to the bank to move money into their IRA account. They parked their truck behind the building, went inside, and never came back out. When officers located Eb, Maggie, and Sylvia in the utility room, they realized that all three had been shot with a large caliber weapon, which was later identified as a .40 caliber Glock. Police have never publicly disclosed how many times they were shot or where they were actually struck. They have only shared their theory, which is that Sylvia and the Barneses were killed during a botched robbery. And I'm a little confused by that, to say the least. The money was taken. We know the money was not found at the property, so the robbery was completed. And as far as it being botched, how do we know that the original intent of the robber wasn't to also kill anybody inside? Lane Bryant murders. Perfect example. The person could have went in, taken what they wanted, and then left, but no, they brought him to the back of the facility and he killed everybody. So could have been the same thing here, where the plan all along was to go in there, take the money, and murder anybody inside. So then in that case, it's not a botched robbery, it's a robbery and a murder. So from where I'm sitting, we definitely have a robbery and we absolutely have three murders. Whether that was the intention all along or not, I don't know, and unfortunately, we probably won't have that answer until we find the person responsible. So within hours, the FBI, state police, and three sheriff offices were brought in to assist with the processing of the scene and investigating the murders and bank robbery. The Greenville News reported that investigators found no signs of struggle, and it appeared the victims had done everything they were told. They also found very little evidence beyond shell casings. All of the blood evidence was contained inside the utility room, and according to investigators, there was no usable fingerprints or fiber evidence because the bank was a public space. I'm going to talk about that later because this is 2003, and as much as the security systems were antiquated, so was the technology when it comes to blood evidence, fingerprints, and trace evidence, specifically DNA. So maybe there's something we can do there, and we'll get into that in the perspective. Investigators also canvassed the area for witnesses, and they located one customer, a regular at the bank, who said he had been inside just after 1 p.m. He came in for a routine wire transfer and told investigators he was there for about 10 minutes. When he left, he said that Sylvia was alone in the bank. The Greenville News reported that investigators also spoke with construction workers nearby, and they said shortly before the police arrived, they saw a red car with two people inside leaving the bank and heading towards State Highway 14. Additionally, police searched for surveillance footage inside the bank, and as I mentioned earlier, there were multiple cameras installed. And investigators believed that they would finally get the break they were looking for, but there was one problem, and we're going to talk about it right after the break. I'm excited to tell you about the world's number one expanding garden hose and their brand new product, the Pocket Hose Ballistic. Look, I do not like taking care of my lawn. I abuse my hose. I drag it all over the asphalt driveway. I tug it this way. I tug it that way. But the Pocket Hose Ballistic handles it all. This hose has changed my landscaping life. It's the toughest pocket hose ever built, reinforced with liquid crystal polymer used in bulletproof vests, something I know a little bit about. It's super lightweight, easy to manage, easy to store, and when you want to use it, you turn the water on, it grows, and then when you turn the water off, it shrinks back down to pocket size. Pretty self-explanatory. It also comes with the pocket pivot, which gives you total freedom of movement at the spigot with 360-degree rotation. You move, it follows, and the water flows. And listen, I'm sure there are some of you saying, Derek, it's just a hose. But the pocket hose carries over 100 patents worldwide. So this isn't your typical hose. And now, for a limited time, when you purchase a new Pocket Hose Ballistic, you'll get a free 360-degree rotating pocket pivot and a free thumb drive nozzle. Just text DETECTIVE to 64000. That's DETECTIVE to 64000 for your two free gifts with your purchase. One more time. Text DETECTIVE to 64000. Message and data rates may apply.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, so we're back from break, and I had just mentioned that investigators are there, and they're thinking, okay, we got to look for surveillance footage. There's cameras all over the place. Where's the videotape? Where's the VHS? So they check the surveillance system, and that's when they discover that the VHS tape is missing. Investigators determined that either no tape had been inserted that day or it had been removed by the killer. Sylvia's son David was adamant that his mother placed the tape in the machine every morning, so in his view, that meant it had been taken. Either way, detectives could not say for certain what had happened. We're left with more questions than answers there, but the bottom line, there's no video. They have the security system, and yet they don't have that VHS tape, so therefore, they got nothing from inside the bank. But with that being the case, you can't just take your ball and go home. You can't quit. You have to find another route, right? You have to find a way to still get to your destination, which means expanding the search outside the bank and looking for video that may allow you to see who was coming and going from the bank around the time when this incident occurred. And that would require you to go to different businesses to see what you can find. According to Unsolved Mysteries, investigators were able to obtain surveillance footage from two nearby gas stations. The video was grainy, but it showed a red car at 1:24 p.m. driving along Frontage Road toward the bank. 3 minutes later, the Barnes' truck was seen traveling in the same direction. At 1:30 p.m., the silent alarm inside the bank was activated. Then at 1:33 p.m., you see the red car captured on video again, but this time it's speeding away from the area of the bank. So based on that timeline, investigators believe the red car could in fact be involved, but they couldn't say for sure because there was no footage placing the vehicle directly at the bank. What was interesting about this case is that they did take that video surveillance footage and send it off to NASA and the Secret Service for enhancement, but despite their efforts, they still couldn't read the registration plate. And this is something, unfortunately, we deal with a lot. You can enhance it and maybe get a better description of the vehicle, maybe get a couple distinguishing marks on the vehicle to help you identify it. But that registration plate, man, it is so hard. Even with some of the cameras today, if you have to zoom in a lot, it gets pretty pixelated and it's hard to make it out. So it really is a barrier to entry in certain cases where we need a registration plate. I'll tell you that even with some of the cameras that you're putting in your houses right now, if you really want to test them out, take a second, put your car out front, park it about 15 feet away, and then zoom in on the plate. If you can read that plate, you're doing good. If you can read that plate from the street in front of your house, you're doing great. That is the number one test I would recommend for everybody out there when deciding on what camera to get. So without being able to identify the registration plate, they still had a pretty good visual of the vehicle itself. So investigators then consulted with experts from Car and Driver magazine to determine the make and model of the vehicle. And they were eventually able to narrow it down to an Oldsmobile Alero. With that information, investigators went to the media and released the footage and description of the vehicle. They continued looking into the lead and compiled the list of approximately 100 red Aleros registered in the area, but unfortunately, as far as we know, that didn't go anywhere. And based on that information, I think we can reasonably deduce, under the assumption that law enforcement did a proper job of vetting all 100 red Aleros, that more than likely the vehicle is not from this area. If they went to every single one of them, cross-referenced information, confirmed that that particular car wasn't in the area on that day and time, well, then that means that the red Alero that we're looking at is not from this community, is not from this area. And one interesting wrinkle that came up while searching for this vehicle was that investigators discovered that a red Alero had been stolen from a rental company at the Columbia, South Carolina airport about 100 miles from Greer. And this was 15 days before the murder. And we're going to talk more about this stolen vehicle a little later in the story, because I will tell you, it's going to be heavily involved in one of our theories and may identify who's responsible for these murders. So the investigation continued with law enforcement working around the clock. And based on what they knew at that point, investigators were not sure how many people were actually involved with the crimes. If you remembered earlier, I said that the construction workers reported seeing two individuals inside the red car, but detectives were never able to confirm this detail because, again, there was no video footage that could be enhanced enough to see how many people were actually inside the red car. So from this point forward, as we continue to go through the story for the sake of simplicity, I'm going to refer to the robber as one person, but I want to make it perfectly clear that we're unsure whether there was one or more people involved in this crime. Speaking of the crime, I want to talk more about it because at this point, investigators were starting to develop a potential theory. They told Unsolved Mysteries they weren't exactly sure whether the robber initially intended to kill anyone or not, though they did believe the bank may have been watched beforehand. Maybe the robber was parked somewhere with a clear view of the parking lot, and when they saw just one car out front, they may have thought it was the perfect opportunity to commit this robbery. So they went into the bank at approximately 1:30 p.m., and as Sylvia grabbed the bait money, the silent alarm was triggered, notifying police. It's possible at that point, Eb and Maggie were already inside the bank, or maybe they walked in and surprised the robber. Either way, the robber likely had all three of them held at gunpoint and then led them to the back utility room. And as they went down this hallway, there was a device on the wall that was blinking and it said, quote, bill trap. So investigators believe that the robber may have seen that and then realized that the police were on their way. What they don't know is whether the plan was always to kill them or if that decision was made after seeing this alert on the wall. Either way, all three victims were taken into the utility room and they were shot. And to me, this theory does appear to be pretty sound. I did mention earlier that the Barneses parked behind the bank, so the robber would not have seen their vehicle. And if Sylvia parked in the front, that would have been the only vehicle they would have seen. And if they had been at this location on a previous occasion, maybe multiple times, more than likely they would have connected the dots and figured out that this vehicle that they were seeing in front more than likely belonged to an employee. So at that point, they say, okay, it's around lunchtime. You know, a little bit after, maybe everyone's back at work. I'm going to go inside. This is my best opportunity to get in and get out without being seen by anybody else coming to the bank. And unfortunately for the Barneses, they may have already been inside, or as detectives have theorized, they might have came in during the actual robbery. And if you're asking me, I think the latter is more likely. Based on the surveillance footage that we have from the car, we know that we see the red vehicle 3 minutes prior to the Barneses vehicle. So unless the robber sat outside in the parking lot for a few minutes, he would have been inside before them. So that was the running theory at that time, but you still need the evidence to support it. And that involves boots on the ground, doing the legwork, and that's exactly what happened. The investigation continued and detectives interviewed hundreds of people, and they actually ended up hearing from a customer who was in the bank prior to 1 p.m. They said that while they were there, a white man in his early 50s was inside acting shady. He was approximately 5'6" tall to 5'8" tall and weighed approximately 230 pounds. He had short blonde hair with a touch of gray, and he was described as having a clean-cut appearance. Now, a sketch of this man was made, but he was never identified. I'm going to put the sketch up on the screen for you now if you're watching on YouTube. If you're listening on audio, I strongly recommend you check it out. It is important to note that the sketch of the man is not necessarily a sketch of the killer. Police have never said they think this man is the killer. They have only said they would like to speak with him and see if he knows anything. But I do think it's important that after all these years, this man has never came forward. Again, small community, an even smaller amount of people who entered the bank on that day. You'd have to be living under a rock if you're from that community to not know that people were looking to speak with you. Your face is all over the screen. You would know that you were in the bank that day shortly before the robbery, and you'd probably tell a lot of people, oh my God, I was there only 30 minutes before this went down. And someone would probably get to you and say, yeah, so-and-so, detectives are looking to speak with you. Here we are though, 2026, this man has never been identified. So to me, that's suspicious, but I would love to hear your opinions. And as far as the investigation itself, I'm very critical of some of the work that's done in other cases, but I have to tell you, I feel like overall, law enforcement did a very good job with this case. They really went the extra mile. They used the resources at their disposal. They had multiple jurisdictions and multiple agencies involved with trying to find this person as fast as possible. They checked their egos at the door. They were asking the community for help. They didn't sit on things. And they did try some innovative tactics, including going back and reviewing 6 months of bank surveillance footage prior to the robbery. And this footage, remember, was 4 split screens. So this was a massive undertaking to review all of this footage. Now, unfortunately, as far as I can tell, it didn't go anywhere, but still to have the manpower to sit there and go day by day to see if just on one day over the past 6 months, someone matching the description of the person in the sketch popped in that store, that's a lot. 8 hours of footage and not being able to fast forward through it. That's a lot of time and effort. And yeah, it's part of their job. That's what they should be doing. But if there's anything you guys have learned on this channel from me, just because it's supposed to be done doesn't mean it always is. And I'm glad to see that they went that extra mile because they had to go through it to find that there was nothing there, but it doesn't take away from the effort. And the effort was there on all fronts. The investigators were going full speed ahead. They even worked with America's Most Wanted and distributed thousands of flyers featuring a $50,000 reward offered by the bank. They were doing everything they could to find the people responsible. There was no stone left unturned. It wasn't for lack of effort, but unfortunately, and this sometimes happens, none of the leads panned out. And by May of 2004, 1 year had passed and they were no closer to solving the case. But that was about to change. We're going to take a break and then we're going to talk about it. I'm excited to tell you about the world's number one expanding garden hose and their brand new product, the Pocket Hose Ballistic. Look, I do not like taking care of my lawn. I abuse my hose. I drag it all over the asphalt driveway. I tug it this way. I tug it that way. But the Pocket Hose Ballistic handles it all. This hose has changed my landscaping life. It's the toughest pocket hose ever built, reinforced with liquid crystal polymer used in bulletproof vests, something I know a little bit about. It's super lightweight, easy to manage, easy to store, and when you want to use it, you turn the water on, it grows, and then when you turn the water off, it shrinks back down to pocket size. Pretty self-explanatory. It also comes with the pocket pivot, which gives you total freedom of movement at the spigot with 360-degree rotation. You move, it follows, and the water flows. And listen, I'm sure there are some of you saying, Derek, it's just a hose. But the pocket hose carries over 100 patents worldwide. So this isn't your typical hose. And now for a limited time, when you purchase a new Pocket Hose Ballistic, you'll get a free 360-degree rotating pocket pivot and a free thumb drive nozzle. Just text DETECTIVE to 64000. That's DETECTIVE to 64000 for your 2 free gifts with your purchase. One more time. Text DETECTIVE to 64000. Message and data rates may apply.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, so we're back from break, and earlier in the episode, I mentioned a red Alero being stolen from the rental car company. So while investigators were working the case, they received a tip from the police in Georgia, and according to the Greenville News, they had pulled over a red Alero that had been stolen from the rental car company at the Columbia, South Carolina airport 15 days before the bank murders. Officers who pulled the stolen car over soon realized that the driver, Emerson Wright, was wanted for arson and robbery by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. But at the traffic stop, Wright ran off into the woods and officers were unable to locate him. Georgia police thought that he could be involved in the Blue Ridge Bank case, so they contacted the investigators there, which is exactly what you're supposed to do. That's how you solve these cases. So once investigators in South Carolina received this information, they start to look into Wright and they found that he had a long history of committing robberies. And guess what? He was known to use a .40 caliber weapon. He went by multiple names, including Ernest Wright and Akeem Johnson, and he lived in the Columbus, South Carolina area and possibly also in Atlanta. Investigators considered him to be their best person of interest so far, but they were unable to place him in Greer. There were no phone records, receipts, or anything proving he had been there. Investigators tried to find Wright for questioning, but they were unable to locate him, so they kept digging. Then in August of 2005, Wright got into a high-speed chase with Georgia police after they tried to pull him over for a series of robberies and burglaries in Atlanta and Augusta. And unfortunately, during this high-speed chase, Wright eventually wrecked his car. But before anyone could put him into custody, he shot and killed himself. And this is obviously a huge blow to the case, if for no other reason than to rule Wright out. So you have to imagine the investigators in South Carolina are back home and they're thinking that this guy may be the key to this case. And unfortunately, a lot of the answers to their questions died with him. But it doesn't mean you can stop. This has happened before. I've experienced it where maybe they don't kill themselves, but you find out that even though you thought they were involved, they had nothing to do with it. And it can be demoralizing because you spent a lot of time looking into this person. But over time, as I got further in my career and gained more experience, I realized that one step in the wrong direction was still one step toward the right one. And that's the way I started to look at things, linear, where instead of it being a spider web and having to start from ground zero, it was more of a journey. And there were going to be bumps along the road. There were going to be stops. But eventually, hopefully, I'd get to the destination. So with Wright being gone, investigators working the Blue Ridge Bank case continued looking into him because even with him being dead, it doesn't mean he's innocent. And one of the things they were able to do was analyze the gun that he had used to take his own life. And when they did, they found it to be different from the gun used in the bank. You would have liked it to be the same gun because that means even though Wright is not going to answer for what he did, they found their guy. But that's not the case. Does it completely exonerate him? No, but we have to be realistic here and acknowledge the fact that we really didn't have nothing putting him at the scene before that. So without this gun being a match, it's truly possible that Wright had nothing to do with this particular robbery, even though he was a horrible guy. And I do have to point out that even though on the surface, it doesn't look like he's the guy, the investigators who were actually working the case at the time felt like Wright fit the profile of someone who could have pulled off the Blue Ridge Bank case, and they just wanted more information about him. So in 2007, they told the media for the first time that they considered Wright to be a suspect. They shared information about Wright and said that they were hoping to speak with anyone who knew him. Now, as far as I can tell, no one came forward with information about him that led to any new leads or possibly put an ending to this case, because if it had, I wouldn't be covering it. So let's fast forward to 2016, because after this information came out in 2007, there wasn't really anything being publicized, nothing at least worth mention. And so police decide to give an update in 2016 to Crime Watch Daily. And they said that the case remained open and leads were still coming in. And still at this point in 2016, Wright was still their only suspect. One investigator elaborated by saying, quote, "I think he's the best person we have to look into. I can't say that he committed the murders. We need some more information." Months later, investigators thought they might have another suspect when serial killer Todd Kohlhepp was arrested. He confessed to committing a quadruple murder in November of 2003 at the Superbike Motorsports in Chesney, about 40 minutes away from Greer. Given the close proximity in distance and time, questions quickly surfaced about whether Kohlhepp could be responsible for the Blue Ridge Savings Bank murders as well. So investigators questioned him about the case, but he denied any involvement. He was eventually ruled out as a suspect, and years passed again without any major updates. By 2023, 20 years had passed since Ebb, Maggie, and Sylvia were killed inside the bank. Investigators renewed their efforts to find the killer by releasing a 10-minute video about the case. And I watched the video. It's really well done, and it gives you a lot of insight about the area which this whole thing occurred. It also allows you to see some interviews from investigators who were working on the case when it happened and are still working the case to this day. You also get to hear from Sylvia's son, Kevin, who was at the bank shortly before she was killed. And there's one particular part in the video where you can hear the guilt in his voice. And he's reflecting on the fact that he wasn't there. And if he had been, would the outcome have been different? Could he have saved her and everybody else that was there? And, you know, I can't see into the future. I can't see into the past. But based on what we know here, unless he had a gun on him as well, more than likely, if he was still there with Sylvia eating lunch, he would be dead as well. And I don't know much about his life now and if he has a family or who's involved in his life. But I know him living shouldn't be a guilt that he carries around, because Sylvia wouldn't want that. Ebb and Maggie wouldn't want that. What happened, happened. There's nothing that you could have done to change that, Kevin. And the other parts of the video where you talk about how you've dedicated your life to not only getting justice for your mother, but for also for Ebb and Maggie, that's why you're here. That's why you continue to move on. And I really hope that as this investigation continues, at one point, I'm watching a video of you looking into the camera saying, "We got him." That's what I want. But overall, I thought the video was very well done, and it was brilliant. It's a good strategy because it accomplished multiple things. It made the victims relatable to anybody watching. You know, you could see your own mom or dad or uncle or aunt in there, and that may incentivize you to want to help. But it also got the facts of the case out there. So if you hadn't heard of it before, and maybe you possess information that can help, it could also trigger something and guide you to where you need to go to provide that information. Up to this point, we don't know if that video has had a positive impact on the case. And unfortunately, it is the most recent update we have in the investigation. The murders of Sylvia Holtzclaw and Ebb and Maggie Barnes remain unsolved, and investigators are still searching for the person or people responsible. All right, so let's dive into this perspective, elaborate on a few of the things I said, and also talk about how they tie into potential suspects and or theories. We talked about what we have in this case. We believe it's a red Oldsmobile Alero. We're to believe that over 100 of those vehicles were identified from that area, and they were all vetted and ruled out, which left this stolen Alero that had been driven by Emerson Wright. But even with that vehicle being identified, there's still a possibility that we don't have the right one. And at this point, I feel confident in saying that if those vehicles were all thoroughly vetted, which is a big if, because I didn't do it myself, and we know that things can be missed. But if it was, and we've also ruled out Emerson's red Alero, which it doesn't seem like they have, because they're still calling him a viable suspect. You have to expand the pool. And with that comes the possibility that the person responsible for this is not from that community and may have been just passing through. We talked about the highway located right there. We can throw it up on the screen again for you if you're watching on YouTube, but it's literally a throwaway. I could take a baseball and throw it across the highway from the front of that bank. This is such an interesting area, and if you're driving through there, there's obviously signage at that time that would identify it as a bank, but I could see how someone driving through there would say, look at this small town, look at this bank and how unsecured it really is. It's basically a trailer, and they got money inside this thing. This is basically one big ATM. I'm on the road. I need money quickly. There's nobody around. I only see one car outside. I'm pulling over. I'm going to walk inside, get the lay of the land, see what I'm up against. And if it looks easy, I'm going for it. And at one point, like it's been theorized by investigators, the robber realizes that the bait trap has been triggered, and that may have enraged him. It may have caused him to panic. And maybe at that point he realizes cops are coming. I got to get rid of any witnesses. I don't have time to clean up. I'm going to kill them. Or he was just angry and he felt like they had tried to pull a fast one on him. And so in that moment, because we're clearly not dealing with a sane individual, he kills them to prove a point. Oh, you thought you had the drop on me? Well, look at this. And then this person flees the area. And if we were to believe the construction workers, there's a possibility that there were two people inside, or there was one person inside and there was also a getaway driver. But again, that information as far as the two people, it's unsubstantiated. But that same hypothetical situation that I give you once the robber is inside, that is applicable to almost every theory, whether it's Emerson Wright, the guy in the sketch, or someone from the community, someone who lived there, who knew the area, who knew Sylvia, who knew the layout, who knew would be coming and going, and was hard up for cash for one reason or another, and decided to rob this bank because they knew the security was subpar. And that's really where I'm at on this case when it comes to potential suspects. We're looking at a transient who is passing through the area who may have a previous criminal history or may only have a couple blemishes on their record. We also have Emerson Wright, who had stolen that vehicle, who may have been hard up for cash and knew of this bank or drove by this bank and decided this is where he was going to get his money. And then we have the possibility that the man in the sketch is exactly the guy we're looking for. He may have went in that bank around that time to look around and case the joint. And because there were multiple people in there, he decided to go back out to his car. And then once everyone left and he only saw Sylvia's vehicle, he went back inside and carried out the robbery. And again, everything that I just laid out earlier about this potential transient and how it all went down, that could still be the case here. And I will tell you, I know it seems like investigators are zoning in on Emerson Wright, and that's fine. They know more about the case than me. But the fact that this guy has not came forward, and I know I talked about it earlier in the episode, that's extremely alarming to me. Because at this point, 20 years later, we got videos all over the place. It was national news at some points. And we're to believe that one of the few people who were in the bank that day didn't realize that investigators were looking to speak with him. If he was just a normal Joe Schmo from the community who was going in there to cash a check, he didn't realize that, hey, cops got my face plastered all over the screen. It's a sketch, but they're looking for me, and this isn't good. To me, the fact that he hasn't come in, I got to tell you, Emerson Wright could be good for it, but I would put the sketch guy right up there next to him. And finally, I mentioned it quickly a few minutes ago, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't mention the possibility of an inside job, whether it was someone who worked at the bank or was a family member or friend of someone who worked at the bank or just someone from the surrounding community who may have been very familiar with that area and knew that if they went inside, they would approximately have 15 to 20 minutes to get in and get out because it's going to take a while for law enforcement to respond. If they know how many officers work that area during that time and how long it usually takes them to respond to calls in that specific location, they may have said, you know what? I need some money. I need it now. I can get in, get out. Nobody gets hurt. and I'm on my way. And unfortunately, things didn't work out that way. He goes in there, takes the money, he's given the bait trap, it triggers the alarm, and he realizes at this point, oh no, they're on their way. I have to take out everybody who could potentially identify me. Or he decided before ever walking in there that he was going to kill at least Sylvia because she might recognize him. She might know him from a previous event. So we'll never know. We'll never know what the mentality was of this individual or these individuals when they walked inside the establishment. It might have been the plan all along to go in there, get as much money as you can, and get rid of any witnesses. That would not be out of the realm of possibility here. Like I mentioned at the top of the show, that's exactly what happened in the Lane Bryant case. And there are multiple individuals out there who are notorious for this type of behavior. Go in there, take what you want, leave no eyewitnesses behind. And that would play to the theory that this is someone who's a habitual offender and may have been committing crimes like this throughout the country. So where does that leave us? Where do we go from here? Well, one of the most disheartening parts of the story was the lack of surveillance footage from inside the bank. Because if we had that, I'm probably not here telling you this story. But we don't. And it was due to a lack of technology and the low-level security system that was installed at the time, which was proper for the time period. So I'm not knocking the bank. But the reality is, based on the limitations of technology at that time, the killer was able to get away with this, and that's unfortunate. But with the new advancements in science and technology, it may be the same reason that he's caught. What do I mean by that? I know when we originally looked at this case, investigators decided that there wasn't much to be processed as far as trace evidence because it was a public area and there would be DNA and fingerprints and trace evidence from every single person who has ever entered that bank. But I would focus on evidence obtained from the utility room. It's highly likely that way less people had been in that room. And you could probably rule out a lot of the DNA evidence from that room by connecting it to the employees that work there. Now, whatever DNA you had left over that was unidentifiable, there's a start. Another piece of evidence that I would seriously look at would be the shell casings. It was mentioned by law enforcement that they were able to identify the caliber of weapon based on the shell casings. Well, what has been done with those shell casings since? Have they been sent off for further testing using the latest and greatest science and technology? Did the suspect wear gloves when he was loading that weapon? If not, there's a potential that there could still be fingerprints and/or DNA still on those shell casings today if they were preserved correctly. If that's the case, then they need to send them off because that right there could give you the identity of the killer. And by the way, if any investigators from this case are watching this episode right now and behind closed doors, you're saying, well, that's great, Derek. We would love to send these shell casings off and have them processed for DNA, but we're a small organization. We don't have the money. I'm right here. Give me a call. Send me an email. I'll sign an NDA. If you can provide me any information to say, hey, listen, we have something. If you're willing to spend the funds, we can process it. And maybe, just maybe, we get something. I'm in. Say less. I'll do anything I can to help. Just reach out. And if there's something you need, I'll get you the lab and I'll get you the funding. We'll be good to go. No problems there. That will not be the reason this case is not solved. And then whatever DNA we find, whether it's from the shell casings or from the utility room, if it's unidentified but it's a good profile, we throw it into CODIS and we see if there's a match. Or maybe there's DNA from another crime that's unsolved involving a robbery in a different part of the country. And from that investigation, we're able to compare notes and find a pattern. All it takes is one lead. That's all we need. And we could solve this thing. And that's what I'm really hoping happens. But we can't rely on investigators to do this one, although I have confidence in this agency. We got to do our part as well. And that comes down to someone out there who possibly knows something. Maybe they don't even know at this point that they have information that's critical to this case. But we got to keep providing these stories and getting it out to all the people we can, because that's how we reach them. So just to recap, on May 16th, 2003, Sylvia Holtzclaw, Dr. James Albert Barnes, and his wife Margaret Barnes were found shot to death inside the Blue Ridge Savings Bank in Greer, South Carolina. The bank's silent alarm had been triggered at 1:30 p.m., and surveillance footage from nearby gas stations showed a red car arriving just before and speeding away minutes later. The bank's own VHS surveillance tape was missing. Investigators later identified Emerson Wright as a potential suspect, but they were never able to place him in Greer on the day of the murders. We also have the unidentified male who was in the bank shortly before the robberies and murders occurred, and to this day, even though we have a sketch, he has not been identified. Overall, more than 20 years later, this triple homicide remains unsolved. So if you have any information, please contact the FBI office in Greenville, South Carolina at 803-551-4200 or the Greer Police Department at 864-848-2151. My final words, as always, go out to the friends and family of Eb, Maggie, and Sylvia, and I strongly recommend that each and every one of you go watch the video because you can see how this tragedy, even 20-plus years later, has still had an impact on that community to this day, not only on the police department, but everyone from that area. I only mentioned it quickly at the beginning of the episode, but giving back to the community was such a big thing for Sylvia. And after she was murdered, friends of hers came to her sons and said, hey, we'd like to still honor her and we'd like to do a toy drive in her name. We're going to call it the Sil Sil Toy Drive. Well, they did. And that toy drive still goes on to this day. So that's where we are. We have certain pieces of this case. We need more, and we're going to need everyone's help to get it done. And I hope that one day, very soon, I'm sitting right here letting you know that we finally have an ending to the story. We finally know what happened on that day in 2003, and the people responsible have been identified and hopefully are being held accountable for what they did. Until that day comes, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.